Hey folks, how are you? Welcome back to Mental Health, the show that's all about helping you take back control of your emotional well-being. My name's Hugh James. I'm a podcaster from Ireland who has been in recovery from depression and addiction over the last 15 years. And this is...
Hey everybody, I'm Steve Ilardi. I'm a psychologist currently from... From the USA, always in the USA.
Born in the USA, my dude, let's go.
Yeah, I did Wellcup Secret, did live in the UK for 3 years during high school. So, you know, I got a little tiny bit of international cred, but for the most part, yeah, I'm an American, born and bred. Fellow traveler with all of you, I'm so honored and delighted to be joining you again. We're going to talk about this journey of wellness and mental health and how to deal with some of the pain and slings and arrows that come our way and how we can be thriving amidst some of the challenges of life. So what do you got for us today?
Yeah, today we're jumping into another Patreon Q&A episode. So for everyone who supports us on Patreon, big thank you to you. And you also have the possibility of sending in questions for myself and Steve. We have a real treat here. We have an audio submission, which is, you know, that is the be all and end all of Q&A. If someone sends in an audio one, I'm just like instantly, yes, we got to check this one out. So let's see what we have for us. Wow, I love that. In and out doesn't linger. Thanks, Peter. Appreciate that question, man. So I guess... where I would kind of start off is thinking back to times in my life where I've been in a crisis, particularly whenever it comes to depression, and just even broader than that. The thing that helps me the most is whenever my friends and my family initiate. For any longtime listeners or viewers who've checked out some of our Depression 101 content, you'll know that one of the key symptoms of depression is like a complete lack of desire to do just about anything. And so when you're in the tailspin of depression, you're just trying to get through your day, and you're not even trying to get through your day, you're trying to get through your next hour. And so the last thing that you can really think of is summoning the energy or finding the strength to like send the message or get the phone call out or get the calendar out and like make an appointment to see like one of your best friends. And one of the best things I think that we can do for people in a crisis is to take that first step, to be that initiating force. And don't be afraid of maybe getting blown back a little bit, and don't be afraid of them maybe not responding, them ghosting you. So initiate, but then keep on initiating.
Yeah, that's so important, Hugh. That's so striking about what you just said to me as a clinician. By the way, first of all, I love the fact that we get this question about how to deal with somebody in crisis. And the non-clinician in our partnership, he's just jumping all over it. I really appreciate, because... you're giving such a valuable perspective on both sides of this equation, right? You've been there in crisis, but now you're at a place in your journey where you are there for people in your life who are in crisis. And I think that just validating that point, that those of us who've been in a dark place often have the best radar to see the crisis and also the greatest compassion. And by the way, a lot of times, if you have been there yourself, I just want to put this out there for our listeners, for our audience. Everything that we've gone through, every pain that we've encountered can carry within it the seeds of something redemptive. And if we've been through that darkness ourselves, we've been in the crisis, if we get through it and we get to the other side and we find some healing, we find some recovery, now other people are, believe it or not, they're going to be able to tell often. They're going to be like, this is somebody who gets it. And we're going to have better radar. We're going to be able to see like, hey, I recognize that. And then that takes me to the point you just made, which is so critical. And I think so many of us miss, which is if you initiate with someone who's hurting, who's in crisis or just shut down, there's a really good chance they're going to blow you off. There's a really good chance that they're going to be like, yeah, no, I'm sorry. And then our human reaction is just to be like, okay, well, fine. I tried. Hey, it's on them now. It's on them.
I take the box, man. What are you going to do about it, bro? Huh? It's your job to reach out and take hold of it. I've extended you the hand.
Absolutely. And it's a very normal human reaction. And yet I have to remind myself, and I remind my students, I mentioned I've done a training workshop recently for a whole bunch of clinicians in Colorado, and it was like a 6-hour training. And one of the things that people came up to me afterwards and said, thank you for reminding me about this point of when you reach out to somebody who's hurting. I was talking about in our own lives. I wasn't even talking about their patients. I was like, in our own lives, there are going to be people that you reach out to and they're going to ghost you. They're going to blow you off and you're going to have your feelings hurt. And it's like, my friends, it is not about you. It is not about you and your hurt feelings. We have to be able to be bigger than that. And I'm preaching to myself here, by the way. It's like, I'm not a fully enlightened Zen master on this particular point. But the times when I have been able to be mindful and to say, oh, that's your hurt feelings. You got to get beyond your ego. Keep reaching out. This is their depression that's causing them to shut down and pull away. Or this is their addiction that's causing them to shut down and pull away. I love that you went there right off the bat.
You know, and it obviously depends on the closeness of relationship that you have with the individual as well. But, you know, if you know this person really, really well, it's very, very easy to ghost like a WhatsApp message. It's not so easy to ghost and knock on the door, you know, and that seems like so foreign and so alien and so invasive. But, you know, I was talking to someone in the village where I live in Ireland here. They were just saying how people don't call by each other's houses anymore. And that just would have been commonplace. Like your front door would have been open to people coming in and just a conveyor belt of cups of tea being served like out of your living room every single day. Now, you know, we're not talking about like invading somebody's space, but if you're really close with a person, like, don't be afraid to swing by and a quick knock on the door, and you can bring like a token like gift to them, and you know, like a loaf of bread or like some milk. Oh, you know, I thought maybe you needed this, just to have that physical touch point so that if they are in a crisis, you know, you can kind of maybe see in that moment that they actually do need help, or they can just be like, actually, I'm doing fine, like back off. And you can be like, okay, I get it. You're not ghosting me because you're in a crisis. You just actually need some space right now. And that's totally cool. But the other thing that I wanted to say was, you know, it's kind of to your point, Steve, like it's so easy to like offer some help. So even like in situations where like maybe it's not like a crisis, maybe it's like someone's just given birth, or it is a crisis, maybe a family member's passed away and, you know, the funeral's going on. Most people in your life will be like, oh, like if there's anything I can do to help you, like just let me know. The same principle applies. You actually have to be the person to initiate. Be specific with your offer and don't say, is there anything I can do for you? Say, hey, I would like to do X. Is that okay? So for example, you've just had a baby. Is it okay if I bring you 5 lasagnas for your freezer? 9 times out of 10, people are going to say absolutely. Or for the person who's depressed, or pick any crisis you want. I would love to schedule a weekly walk with you every single Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Is that okay? Because that's specificity. Whoa, I just about got that one out there. Is really, really important because it removes the burden of initiation. It removes the burden of choice for somebody who doesn't have the cognitive capacity to think through and really, really make plans during that time.
Yeah, I love it. Absolutely. Now, I think we can drill down a little bit further in this idea of, or this concept of crisis, because that is a very, very all-encompassing broad word. It can mean anything. From, like you just said, oh, it's a positive event, the birth of a child, for most of us, at least, the birth of a child. But it is a kind of acute crisis from the standpoint of, yeah, we've both been there, right?
DEFCON 1. How many times can we bring DEFCON into these episodes? We're going to have to add it to the mental health bingo card.
Absolutely. Depending on how things progress in Ukraine, it might be all too salient for everybody. He was just looking at me like, dude, I cannot believe you just went there.
No, I'm just like, what can I say to that other than like, thoughts and prayers to Ukraine.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, they've been on our hearts, a lot of us. No matter when you listen to this, hopefully that'll bring back some memories of folks that you've been thinking about. Crisis can be anything.
So sorry, just to loop this back, there are some individuals in our community who are fostering Ukrainian teens who are coming in as refugees. And there are also members in our community who are just taking in kind of like whole families. We're really, really stretching the boundary here, but that is a form of a crisis for those families because their world is going to be upside down.
And for the folks they're hosting.
I'm actually talking about the hosts. I'm being rude and just forget about the refugees whose crisis is obvious. That specific offer, even in that scenario of, can we give you $100 a month over the next 2 years? You know what I mean? Like something specific like that is going to go a long way instead of just a token like, oh, you know, like I said earlier, thoughts and prayers, like, anything we can do, let you know. Because who in the right mind is going to reach out to you and be like, yes, actually, can you supply us with $50 worth of groceries for the next few months? You know, we're not built that way.
Absolutely. No, that's beautiful. A crisis can be nearly anything disruptive. But I felt like with this question, at least one of the ways that I interpret that question as a mental health professional. In our clinical settings, when we say this patient is in crisis, it has a kind of a top spin to it where it's like, oh, okay, so are they on the brink of hospitalization? Are they at a level where they can no longer function? They've experienced something traumatic. They are maybe acutely suicidal. And so there's a kind of assessment that comes to my mind. You know, I'm not expecting that this is something that every person listening, every lay person, is going to be thinking like a trained...
Shout out to my lay people.
Yeah, which is most of our audience, let's be honest. But one of the things that happens when I am teaching students in, say, an undergraduate course in abnormal psychology, when we cover crises, we cover suicidality, for example, and I know you and I are going to be taking a deeper dive in a future episode, probably within the next 6 months or so, suicide, the basics and beyond. It's really important when I cover that content with my undergrads that I equip them, that I empower them, that I give them basic knowledge of how to talk with anyone about potential suicidal thoughts. And the very first thing I do, and I want to do it right now, is to normalize it and say, look, first of all, the majority of adolescents at some point in their adolescence or early adult years have had at least fleeting, transient thoughts of death, their own death, suicidality. So it's extremely common. At least one half of everyone who's battling clinical depression has suicidal ideation. They're thinking about death as a possible escape. And we've talked about that a bit on a couple previous episodes. We want to get to a place, I think so many people out there have this weird kind of skittishness, and it may be understandable caution around like, well, wait, I can't possibly, if I ask somebody directly, are you having thoughts of death? Are you having thoughts about hurting yourself? That like, A, I'm going to insult them. I'm going to offend them. There's so much stigma. They're going to think I'm judging them. Or even worse, somehow I'm going to be planting that idea. Oh my God, what if they're hurting and I ask about suicide and that's the thing that gets them thinking about it and now yeah, it's on. Yeah.
If I do some sort of weird psychological inception on them.
Absolutely. I mean, that is a genuinely common fear that I encounter, not only among my students, but just when I speak to lay audiences. So I think the very first thing we have to do is destigmatize talking about suicidality. And to normalize, if you have a friend who is depressed, if you have a friend who is really hurting and they're in pain, even if it's the pain of bereavement, where they've suffered a devastating loss of a loved one or a loved pet, or they're hurting, what I say to people, and I encourage students and lay people, is just like, look, I know that many people, when they're hurting the way you are right now, they find themselves starting to think about death. And sometimes they even start to think about death as a kind of escape. And that's really understandable. And because I care about you and I know you're hurting, I hope you won't mind if I'm just going to be blunt. Like, I'm just going to ask, like, is that something that you've been dealing with? Have you been having those kind of thoughts? And just like very matter of fact, sensitive, thoughtful, empathetic, compassionate, but direct. Have you been having thoughts about hurting yourself or ending your life? And it's astonishing for many people who are on the other side of that question, the feeling of relief. Wait, I'm not going to be judged for this because I feel so ashamed that I'm having these thoughts. I feel so judged. I feel so afraid. Like, this is the most loving thing that we can do for many people who are in that space. Because, I mean, here's the thing that most people don't realize. When someone is having suicidal thoughts, it's not that they want to die. There's a part of themselves always that desperately wants to feel better and live. They just want relief. They just want escape. And so death is alluring to some people because it feels like, oh, well, that would be one possible solution. And they know on some level, like, that's a horrible, horrible solution, but it's there. And so if we enter in that space with them, and there's a whole suicide risk assessment you and I are going to talk about with our audience in a few months, so I'm not going to go through the whole thing right now. But if you ask someone about their suicidality, about thoughts about death, if you find out that they are in fact having those thoughts, then you can very sensitively, delicately, gently probe a bit further. And the big differentiation you want to make is between ideation, like they're having these thoughts, and the thoughts could be passive or they could be active. Passive is like, well, I just wish I would like get hit by a bus, or I wish I would have an aneurysm or a stroke and fall over dead, versus active, like, yeah, I fantasize about hurting myself. But the thing we really care about is intent. Because most people, thankfully, even if they're hurting and they're fantasizing about death, they don't have active intent. They're like, no, but I would never do it. I'm not going to do it because, and then fill in the blank. And the fill in the blank is usually either a connection with somebody in their life that they don't want to abandon or hurt, or some sort of religious commitment or spiritual commitment. Like, you know, it's against my religion. Or maybe fear that's associated with that. I don't want to go to hell if that's part of their religious belief system.
A lot of the guys that I've worked with, it's just kind of like, nah, I couldn't go out that way. You know what I mean? Like, there was just something, I'm going to call it like a stubborn courage, that was just like, you know, I'm literally going through the belly of the beast right now. And like, I would be disappointed if that's what took me out. Do you know what I mean? I don't care if the dragon turns around and burns me alive. Like, that's kind of like an honorable way to go out. But like, I'm not going to fall on my own sword. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And I can tell you again, as a clinician who's worked with hundreds of depressed patients and hundreds of suicidal patients, I'm grateful for any reason that a person has when they're having suicidal thoughts, ideation, anything that will keep them from translating the ideation into intent. So they're like, yeah, I'm having this fantasy. You know, I'm really intrigued by the thought, but like, I would never do it. And here's why, because I could never abandon my cat. I'm like, thank God for Kitty.
Yeah, we'll take whatever's going at that point.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of my practice has been in the so-called American Bible Belt. And, you know, I don't know if you have any analogous situation going on there in Ireland. But in the American Bible Belt, you get a lot of patients who will be like, yeah, I mean, I have this thought, but I would never do it because I don't want to go to hell. And I'm like, dude, I am not engaging in any theological disputation of it. It's like, I kind of think that maybe the Almighty would be pretty compassionate, but we're not going to go there. It's just like, by any means necessary to keep a person engaged with a sense of hanging on and hopefulness, because we're going to get them through this crisis. And then when they get to the other side of it, they're going to look back and they're going to shake their head and say, thank God I did not end my life. Thank God I held on. And I cannot tell you the number of people that I've worked with who wanted to end their life. Not only did they have intent, they had a plan, they had a mean, they were ready to go. When they heal and get well, they look back and, you know, they're so grateful, A, that somebody cared enough to intervene and to keep them from acting. But then they're also just kind of creeped out by like, oh my God, like a hair's breadth away from ending it all, and I would have missed out on all this beauty and all this love and all this joy.
And I think there's a really, really difficult tightrope that we need to discuss between being available for people and initiating, but not taking sole 100% exclusive responsibility for the people around you in your life. Like, you know, I imagine you or lots of people, you know, I've lost multiple friends to suicide. It's a big issue in Ireland, as I'm sure you're aware. And as a, I don't know if survivor is the right word of that, but you know, someone who has experienced loss in that way, the amount of guilt that you can feel and the what if questions, and you know, especially the first two times it happened, like that really ate me up. And I had to really learn, kind of like as I got older, that ultimately you can't control people. It's like big plot twist, but it is such a hard lesson to learn. And you know, ultimately it's people's choice at the end of the day whether or not they choose that final and permanent action.
It is, but can I give a little caveat? As a clinician, I feel that in the vast majority of cases, there are exceptions for somebody, say, who has a fatal condition and they're in agonizing pain at the end of life, where they're like, I want to go out on my own terms. And we can talk about the pros and cons. I know there are people with very strong opinions on both sides of that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about somebody who's clinically depressed or in some adjacent clinical state and they're suicidal. To me, they are not in their right mind at that point. In other words, and this is going to offend some listeners, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. To me, they're in a state of temporary insanity where they are convinced that death is the best possible solution to their suffering. And I'm convinced that that's the depression talking. And so I have had patients involuntarily committed to save their life. And in other words, they had ideation, they had intent, they had a plan, they had means. They were going to take their life. And I knew it because they confided that in me and I had them involuntarily hospitalized.
So this is good. We actually kind of arrived where I was going to go. My kind of whole angle is it comes to a point where you are not enough. You as the friend in the scenario can take the situation as far as you can, but there comes a point where for your own sake, your own well-being, but also for the sake of the person, you have to seek professional help. You have to have that external team because you're too small. You can't deal with it yourself. And the consequences of doing so are devastating for everyone involved.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I mean, and that principle applies to those of us who are trained professionals. If it's somebody in our personal lives, you know, this has happened to me a couple of times. Somebody that is a very dear, either member of my family or close friend, and it's happened in both permutations, where I need to get an objective professional involved because I'm too close to it. And so here's what happens. Even if we take a clinician out of the picture, if any of us are dealing with somebody who is in crisis and suicidal, we are not going to be able to have the objectivity. And, you know, most people are not going to have the training to make the judgment. Does this person need to be hospitalized? Do we need to have a much more drastic intervention to save their life? And so let's just leave it at this. If any of us have someone in our lives, we ask them, and I would encourage all of you, if you have someone you think might be in crisis, to ask them very matter-of-factly, compassionately, respectfully, are you thinking about death? Are you thinking about ending your life? Are you thinking about hurting yourself? And if the answer is yes, and then the follow-up question is there a way that you could see yourself ever doing that? Are you able to keep yourself safe or not? That's clinical language, but can you keep yourself safe? And if the answer is, I'm not sure, or I could see myself, then at that moment, that's the break glass in case of emergency. I need it at this moment. I mean, I'm going to make it very direct, very simple. If you have somebody in your life and you think that there is a chance they could be at imminent risk of ending their life, two things have to happen. Number one, they cannot be left alone. Whether it's you with them or somebody else, they cannot be left alone until you get them in touch with a trained professional. Now, the trained professional could be on a suicide crisis hotline, and those are available 24/7, 365 throughout the entire developed world.
Yeah, just Google it, literally, like it will bring you there.
Absolutely. Can be the emergency room of a local hospital. It could be their therapist, their psychiatrist, if they have one. It could be a family practice, their general practice doc. But it has to be a trained professional. And at that point, now they're in professional hands, and Lord willing, they'll get the care that they need. But back to your other point, Hugh, which I really don't want to gloss over, which is, what if you have a friend who is not in that sort of break glass in case of emergency crisis, but they have ongoing thoughts of suicide that they're not intending to act on, but they're kind of on the edge. They're just in a really, really, really bad space, and they're shut down, and they're leaning on you. I have seen so many people get burned out by trying to be the therapist or the professional for their friend. And there's a reason why all of us who are professionals have part of our training. You cannot be a therapist for your friends or family. You cannot be that person because it's a dual relationship. And if you try to take on those dual roles, you're their loved one, you're their clinician, you're going to suck at both roles eventually. And it's going to burn you out. And it's going to damage the friendship. It's going to damage the relationship. But most importantly, it's going to damage you. You're not going to be able to be what they need. And eventually, you're going to be damaged because it's going to be overwhelming and you're going to burn out. And now you're going to be secretly sort of resentful, secretly sort of bitter. And nothing good can come from that. So if you have someone in your life who's chronically in crisis and turning to you instead of a trained professional, then you have to have that hard conversation with them and be like, hey, I care about you. I'm here for you, but I cannot be both your therapist and your friend.
Yeah. And you know, that's like beautiful exercise in boundaries where it's like, I will do X for you, but I will not do Y. That sounds very brutal and kind of formulaic, but that's boundaries, bro. That's the way they worked. It's the intention of, look, I love you and I want to support you. This is my line and I can't tolerate you crossing that line because it's not good for both of us. It's a dance, you know, and you figure out how to do that. But I can't stress enough the importance of keeping your boundaries healthy, because ultimately it's what keeps everything else going. You know, you can't be there for them once you turn resentful or once you burn out. So the sustainability piece is so key there. And you've got the whole team of Avengers around you in the medical and professional space. Hopefully you have other friends and family members of theirs that you can tap into to kind of build a bit of a wider support network around. But
yeah, that's great. I think it really does take some discernment. I'm thinking of a situation right now of a friend who generally very healthy psychologically, but went through a crisis, blew up out of the blue. It was just one of those things. Sometimes life happens, right? And now everybody's rallying around and providing a lot of support that I suppose viewed through a certain lens is therapeutic, but it's very time limited and it's a community, right? It's not one person taking it on. It's a community. And I think there's something so profound and so healing for those of us who are lucky enough to be part of a community, a circle of friends or people who are sort of part of our tribe, part of our team, where we've got each other's backs. Now we can do that as a collective, as it were, as a tribe, where for a month or two, while somebody's dealing with something really painful and difficult, we've got them. We can carry them and lift them up and support them and hold them in an embrace of caring and affection, and we're not going to burn out. But if it's like 6 months later, and you know they're still, or 3 months later even, and they're still struggling, at a certain point, that's where discernment comes in, where we've got to be able collectively and individually to be like, all right, like I am not a trained professional. I'm not going to play one on TV. Actually, I am going to play one on a podcast because I am one. But I feel like almost everything we talk about, you notice how this idea of like, we don't want to do all or nothing thinking. We don't want to be dichotomous thinking, black and white, binary. It's like, it's not a binary. There are some hard and fast rules, but there's a lot of gray area in between where we have to just be discerning and wise.
I don't want to get into this now because I think, I don't even know how we would elegantly package this episode, but I would love to have a conversation with you sometime on that extended piece where, okay, it's 6 months down the line, the whole community is involved, and the individual is not shifting. And I think there is a wider discussion to be had of, it can't get to the point where you can maybe become a bit of an enabling force rather than a motivating forward momentum force in somebody's life. But I think that's for another time. I would love to end just with, I'm going to give my like quick and dirty, like these are the practical things that I actually do. And they're very, very simple. My big thing for my friends when they're in crisis is, try to sneak in as much of the therapeutic lifestyle into whatever it is that we do. So for anyone who's new to this show, new to Steve's work, Steve has this amazing kind of six pillars of treating depression. A big one of them is exercise and movement. So whatever is going on in the person's life, other than if they are like very physically ill, it will always be something like, hey bro, do you want to come over and help me in the garden? Or do you want to come over and shoot some hoops for a while? Or do you want to get in the sauna? Or do you want to go for a swim? Or let's get outside as much as possible. If it's sunny, even better. If we're moving our bodies, even better. If you can get that heart rate elevated, because there's going to be a massive therapeutic benefit to that of exercise. You're with somebody else. So I try to like three or four birds with the one stone. I usually cook them a really delicious, healthy meal as well, because a big turning point in my journey has been really adding the emotional and the physical together. It's let's do something physical while creating this space, this quality time, this really slow bit of time in our schedule where we're open, we're listening without judgment, we're asking lots of questions, but it's in a place that is very, very safe. It gives people the chance to offload whatever it is that they're going through, and they get the added kind of physical therapeutic effects and benefits of whatever activity you sort of choose to do. But it's not just a 30-minute catch-up. It's a, hey, come and spend a Saturday with me, or come and spend when you get out of work or whatever it is. Like, let's spend 3 or 4 hours together, because I'm a podcaster, so what can I say? But you got to let the conversation breathe a little bit sometimes. And it's very difficult to do that in a very sensitive and loving way if it's a 15-minute block on a calendar, you know.
Yeah, I love that. And you mentioned, I think somewhere in there, or maybe I just hallucinated it, but I think you mentioned in there something about kind of giving things space to breathe. And that brings me to a point that I wanted to mention before we close, which is sometimes the most caring thing that you can do for someone in crisis is just to be physically present for them. You don't have to say anything. Here in the States, we have this mythology around like, oh, you have to talk about it. And if somebody has had something bad happen, something painful happen, you got to get them to talk about it. And it's like, no, if they're not talking about it, there's probably a reason why they're not. Now, it may just, the reason may be because nobody has given them that compassionate invitation to tell their story. But there's also the possibility that they don't need that right now, that they're not ready for that right now, that what they need is your physical presence with them. That's very healing. Sometimes what they need is not only your physical presence, but physical appropriate touch, and which has profound effects on our, not only on our circulating levels of stress hormones, but even on our circulating levels of oxytocin, which we talked about in previous episodes as kind of an attachment hormone. But oxytocin gives us a greater sense of well-being and of belonging and place. And so if you've got somebody in your life that's hurting, you can just sit with them. And depending on your relationship and sort of what the boundaries and parameters are, you can be like, hey, can I give you a hug and just hold you for a minute? Can I just hold your hand? Can I touch your arm? Again, within the context of that relationship and what's appropriate, super powerful. And sometime we'll have a deep dive on therapeutic value of pets and therapy dogs. But this semester, I started bringing my dog, Teddy, the Wonder Dog, to class with me. Not always, but every three or four classes I'd bring. And students would go bananas for him. And they're like, Dr. Lardy, why do you call him the Wonder Dog? What's his superpower? And I'm like, his superpower is cuddling.
You just straight up say, you're like, he heals depression.
He does. But I would watch students, you know, I've got pretty good clinical radar, that I knew to be really struggling, just sweep him up in their arms. He's this little kind of fluffball, 15, 17 pounds. And they would just sweep him up and just, and you could just see the joy. So sometimes we get that same kind of thing with the loved one when we're just physically present to somebody.
And I'll end by affirming what you said as someone who, you know, as I've said multiple times, like has been experiencing depression for a long time, depressive episodes throughout life. And most of the time with my inner circle, it's like we hanging out, or maybe I will have initiated, maybe they will have initiated. You know, we'll be doing whatever activity we're doing. And they're like, well, how are you? How are you? And I'm like, yeah, I think I'm depressed. And they're like, okay, do you want to talk about it? And often I'll be like, nope. Or sometimes I'll be like, yes, here's my 30-second kind of download on it. And then that's it. There's nothing more said about it unless I want to. And the rest of the day or the rest of the afternoon, we're hanging out in that physical company, like you're saying. And that is so healing and so therapeutic, just to be around somebody in that non-judgmental space who isn't trying to force you to be a certain way or do a certain thing in a specific timeline. They're not trying to rescue you, or they're not trying to heal you. They're just like, no, I'm here for you. I'm here with you. And for me, one of the most validating things I've ever experienced is I enjoy spending time with you, even if you're not the all singing, all dancing hue that we often get. That's been really moving and really beautiful. So if we can do the same for our friends and family, I can't express to you or explain to you just how beautiful that would be.
That is beautiful. Yeah, no, I love that, because just to say one last thing, and I promise we're already over time.
We could call this show One Last Thing, I think, because we're the absolute kings of one last thing. It's like, I know we're 20 minutes over time here, but I just have 10 more minutes to say.
Oh my God. This is amazing. Yeah, so one last thing. I've had so many people tell me over the years that when they are depressed, when they're hurting, when they're suffering in any sort of way, that they can usually pull it together if they have to when they're around somebody else and put on a facade, put on a happy face. Or as some of my depressed patients have said, I can play normal.
Oh, wow. That is so good.
Isn't it? I can play normal, but it's exhausting. Exhausting. And I was hearing that in what you were just saying. It's like, if you are lucky enough in that space where you're hurting and you've got somebody who is able to give you permission, like you don't have to put on anything. You don't have to entertain me. You don't have to be funny. You don't have to be interesting. We can just sit here and you don't have to take care of me. Like if you're hurting, if you want to have a good cry, whatever, like it's okay. Like I'm here for it. I'm here for whatever. There is no greater gift that we can give that person than the gift of like, you don't have to keep working so hard. I really appreciate you just giving voice to that intuition so that we can kind of put words on it and formalize it and put it out there for anyone who's listening. Like, oh, wow, if I'm hurting, that really is kind of what I'm looking for. If I'm on the other side of that equation, if I have somebody in my life who's hurting, that's a gift that I can give them at any time. You know, they may not be ready to receive it today, but if they are, man, really powerful, really healing. So thank you for that.
Peter, thank you so much for your question. Hopefully there's some semblance of an answer in there. You can comb through it and pick and choose whatever works for you with whatever specific scenario you were kind of asking. We don't know the context. We rarely know the context for these questions, but that's kind of the charm to it, because hopefully no matter where you are listening or watching, you can take some of it to apply for your specific scenario. So Steve, thank you so much for this. Really appreciate it, man.
This has been amazing. By the way, as you were just talking to Peter, I was thinking we're going to have a whole subgenre of Q&A where it's like follow-ups, where people are like, yeah, you guys completely missed the point of my question.
Yeah, Peter sends another message. Hi, guys. All that crisis stuff, you totally got the wrong end of the stick. This is actually what I was looking an answer for.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm ready for it. Bring it on, folks. Part of the beauty of this whole enterprise is it really is a conversation. It's an honor to be part of this unfolding conversation with all of you. So we're here for it. And as always, we're having a great time doing it. So thanks so much, you.
Awesome. So at mentalhealth.fm on all the socials, you can get our website, mentalhealth.fm. You can support the show on Patreon, where you can also submit a question just like Peter did today. And we really appreciate all of our Patreon supporters. Thank you so much for keeping the lights on and making this show possible. And we really look forward to connecting with some of you in a more deeper way around this episode over in the community. So other than that, hope you have a great rest of your day and all the best with whatever is waiting for you at the end of this episode.
Be well, everyone. Thank you.